the lessons in it are things that adults can take away from it, right? How do I wake up, see something, and decide that I'm going to go do something about it? You know, the way I did with the book itself, I saw this gap in the marketplace and I said, I'm going to go do something about that, yeah. Right? Each of us can do that. And I always say that, you know, this is like really basic stuff, but you have to start somewhere, no matter how small. And, you know, maybe it'll lead to raising a really cool kid that does awesome stuff in the world for other people and for their communities. Maybe it leads to, you know, writing a kid's book. I don't know, but you got to wake up and decide that you're going to do something.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer. I am a documentary filmmaker and photographer, and on this show, I interview some of the world's best storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. My guest today is Mina Harris. Mina Harris is a lawyer, activist, and the founder of the Phenomenal Woman Action Campaign, which is a female-powered organization that brings awareness to intersectional social causes. And now, Mina Harris is also an author, with her new children's book titled Kamala and Maya's Big Idea, which is set to come out on June 2nd. The book is based on a true story from the childhood of Mina's mom, Maya Harris, and aunt, Kamala Harris. In it, two sisters make a difference in their community by dreaming big, organizing across diverse groups, and fighting for what they believe in. Senator Elizabeth Warren calls it, quote, a must-read for little girls around the world. And Stacey Abrams says the book is, quote, an inspiring tale. In this conversation, Mina and I talk about the creative process of writing her first children's book, the impact of diverse representation in children's literature, and how stories shape our identities from a young age. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Mina Harris. Mina Harris, thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer Podcast. It is so great to see you.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've communicated over email and phone and text.
That's right.
Back on, in the wake of the Paradise fires, actually. It feels like we're only communicating during disasters.
I know, exactly, these crisis moments.
Yeah.
But I'm glad to see your face and to be reconnected. That feels like it was so long ago now, but it must have only been, what, like a year and a half? I mean, I feel like there's also just been so many fires. But I'm glad to be back.
Yeah. So the last couple months for you, as we're going to be in this show, obviously we're going to be talking about your new book release, your children's book. And so when I was thinking about, okay, like, how do I want to start the conversation thinking about children's books? I was thinking about my mother, who I am sheltered in place with right now.
Okay.
She has two sets, four grandchildren now. And my mom loves watercoloring, and she's always had this idea I'd love to make a children's book for them. And she's just never found the time. And in this quarantine period, she's been writing children's books for her grandkids. And that's been super fun to see.
Oh, that's so amazing.
Yeah. So I was wondering how...
So she's one of these people who's actually being productive. What a model for us all, like struggling to do anything. But that's so beautiful. I love that.
So how old are your... You have two kids, correct? How old are your
two
kids?
Yes, I have two daughters.
Okay.
One, the younger one just turned two, and the older one is three going on four.
Gotcha. So what has parenting been like over the last couple months for you?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, having a two-year-old and a four-year-old already, even outside of a pandemic, is just kind of wild. I will say that I feel grateful that they're young enough where we don't have like formal homeschooling. So it's not been, you know, as I said, it's not been, you know, crazier than it sort of already is having a two-year-old and a four-year-old. Right. For the older one, you know, she was in preschool, and so she misses her friends. We don't have the same, you know, routine of taking her to school in the morning and having that sort of structure, which admittedly was still somewhat new for her because she had just started preschool. But, you know, they've adapted, and that we're lucky to have, you know, access to technology where they can do videos and FaceTimes with their school friends and obviously family. Mm-hmm. So it's not been, you know, totally weird and off-filtered. I'm that we don't have formal homeschooling because I do not understand how people who do have to do that are surviving. I think that it, I mean, it's literally like another full-time job. Yeah. In general, just having a two-year-old and a four-year-old, I think I keep calling her four. She's not four yet. She'll be four next month.
But she will appreciate that though. If she's ever a listener, she's going to be like, thank you for rounding up.
I bet. Exactly. Right. Exactly. It's just, I think also being here in the house and being together nonstop. I mean, and you know, saying that like the days are long and these are short with kids. And as much as that's true, I also just feel like she's just growing so fast. And I joke that for her in particular, in terms of her personality, like it just feels like I have another grown ass adult like living in the house. And each day in terms of speech and being able to have a conversation, it's just wild how fast it goes. Yeah. And I feel like I'm out of body experience sometimes just realizing how fast. I mean, it feels like she was a baby yesterday. And now I have the little one to really, you know, emphasize that, right? To think, oh my God, she was just that little not that long ago. So anyway, yeah. Parenting is wild and weird. And it's like these little people, they become adults way too fast.
How are you using stories right now with kids are two and almost four, whether that is for entertaining the kids or educating the kids? How are stories playing into parenting right now?
Well, it's definitely something I would say, as much as the structure has gone out the window, that is something that we still do maintain. We're reading in the morning and reading before bed. I think in terms of stories, you know, we've always been very communicative with them in terms of, you know, explaining to them what's going on in the world, telling stories about our family, right? Explaining to them, for example, in this moment, why grandma's not here and what grandma's doing. I've started transcribing emails for her to my mom and dad, which has been really interesting too, just sort of, you know, piecing together, how was your day and what did you do? And, you know, having a conversation that way.
You ask your daughter that and then you write the email as she dictates it. Okay. Gotcha.
And then it's funny. So my dad, you know, pop, responded right away. And it was like a very lengthy, you know, answered every question. And then my mom responded with a heart. And I was like, hello, she wants a response. Like, she needs to know what you did today and all the questions she asked you about what are you eating and what are you doing? My mom had just FaceTimed us and I was like, no, she needs an email back. Like, this is part of the, you know, the process. You can't use another medium. Anyway, you know, we've always, I think really relied on, I don't know if I would phrase it as sort of, you know, telling stories, but it's just around communicating in a really full, interesting, you know, sometimes imaginative way. And I think in part having the two of the girls together now with the younger one who's getting older, it's really beautiful and amazing to see them, you know, make believe and take, you know, stories such as Daniel Tiger or other things that we read and incorporate them into their, you know, day to day where in any given moment, I'll say one of their names. She's like, I'm not Amara. Her name is Amara. I'm not Amara. Yeah. I'm Moana I'm, you know, Margaret from Daniel Tiger. So that's really cool to see them, you know, incorporating those characters and those, you know, storylines into their own imagination and into their own experiences together, which is really cute and fun. I last night kissed the little one goodnight and she said, good night, Mom Tiger. She's really into Daniel Tiger right now.
Do you have a bedtime story routine?
Yeah, just reading right before bed, right? I mean, it's kind of a common, especially to get them to sort of calm down. And so that's what I was saying. That part of the structure has definitely stayed. Yeah. And then reading in the morning, too. Uh-huh. I think, what were you going to say?
Go for it.
I was just, you know, this, that part of the structure, we've been able to keep it up. And I would say, I guess, usually we're taking the older one to school early in the morning, but now we have a little bit of, you know, freer time where we can read more and have sort of an easy day. So mm-hmm. it's allowed definitely more space for that. I've definitely been, as a new author, wanting to support other authors who have books coming out right now and have been, you know, doing that as much as I can. And just giving them sort of more, you know, to interact with, right? We just cannot have enough content in these times. So it's been fun to, you know, and again, see them get older and be able to interact with the content in a different way and relate to it in a different way than they did when they were younger.
How does it feel to refer to yourself as an author now? Is that like an identity that you're embracing? Does it feel like a little weird?
It does feel weird, in part because it's not something that I ever aspire to. I mean, it's amazing. It feels so cool. I love it's definitely weird, but I love it. You know, calling myself an author, holding the book for the first time was just kind of incredible. This was never sort of on my roadmap. It was never on my bucket list. It was never something that I thought I would do. And it's interesting to realize that through my women's brand Phenomenal, which is really all about storytelling and really, you know, telling the stories of underrepresented communities through accessible messaging and content. I really love storytelling, and meaning as sort of just something that I have a passion for, and it's definitely been a journey of really realizing that. And right. I think the book has been part of it. Like, it's always been sort of within me, and there are other ways in which I've done that and have been drawn to that process. Yeah. But the book is the first time that I sort of really formally told a story, right? In a really traditional way. So mm-hmm. it's to say that as much as it was not something I expected to do or was something that I aspired to do, mm-hmm. It's very much in line, I think, with what my sort of passions and skills are in thinking about how do you tell stories in an interesting way that really engages, you know, an audience.
Yeah. I mean, you're telling with Phenomenal, you're telling stories all the time.
Constantly.
But this is like a different kind of formalized storytelling. And when it wasn't on your roadmap, and at what point were you like, this now is on the road? Because you're doing so much. And even though it's, you know, a short book, like it takes a ton of work.
It does. And it's funny. I look back on the t-shirt, the Phenomenal Woman t-shirt, and I have a text thread with my family, my parents, and there's a famous moment where I told my parents and Nick, hey, I think I might want to do another t-shirt. I had already had one before mm-hmm. that was about women entrepreneurs. And my mom was like, Nina, do you really think you have time for another t-shirt? Do you really want to add that to your plate? And sort of similarly, I've had people like, you wrote a children's book? Like, how are you making time for this?
Right.
But I think, again, it really does fit into what I've already been doing and finding different ways of sort of continuing that. So the moment, I would say for me, there were several moments. I would say the first one where I think it sort of started to enter my mind was when I became a new mom. And I was reading books to my now, you know, older daughter, and feeling that there was a lack of, you know, representation and characters that I wanted her to see and see herself in the books that we were reading. And, you know, of course we were reading all of the classics like, you know, Goodnight Moon and all of those that are so wonderful. And, you know, these really beautiful, you know, examples of children's literature, but nevertheless, you know, I think we all can recognize that a lot of them are about animals. They're lacking in, you know, central, you know, characters and protagonists that are girls, that are children of color. And I think we've made a lot of progress, but we still have a long way to go. And I felt, you know, like there was not sort of a consistent sort of, you know, story or narrative or, you know, fictional character development that was really strong and powerful that they could relate to. Mm-hmm. And as I said, we've seen, you know, great progress. There's Hair Love, which is a big one for us. Matthew Cherry mm-hmm. wrote that, I think, 2 years ago, which was big for us because she was able to see her hair texture represented, right? And there, of course, is the film short that just won a major award, where, you know, you really get to see it animated and really feel like it comes to life. And likewise, I thought, you know, we had all of these sort of there's been a proliferation of sort of children's feminist literature with, you know, rebel girls and radical women from A to Z. We had our A is for activist book, right? But you have like the one title or two or three, right? That sort of go to these themes and stories, but they're so much more. And I wanted to think about how can we bring that into our household. And also on the topic of, you know, these sort of feminist literature books, I was like, they're important. I want her to learn the history, but if I read another freaking like list of women, I'm tired of lists of women. Like, let's just create actual girl characters that they can relate to. And you asked me earlier, you know, how it is being with them in the house. And I was speaking about sort of them using their imagination and drawing from the books that they read. And that was a big moment for me realizing that, you know, kids, especially in these younger years, learn about the world and interact with the world through books. And what they consume and what they see, they adopt that. They want to be that. They want to emulate that. Mm-hmm. Whatever it may be. And whatever medium. I love this moment during the presidential campaign where there was a drum line and there were all these young black girls who were dancing and using their, you know, drums. And my older one said, I want to be a drummer. I want to be a dancer, mm-hmm. right? It's anything that they see that inspires them, that catches their attention. They want to be that thing. Absolutely. And, you know, again, there's lots of lessons we can learn from like sheep and animals and farm animals, but it's not reflective of everyday life, and it's certainly, you know, not something that they see, like literally see themselves in.
So when you had that epiphany or you had that drive to create what you saw missing, which I think is like how so many amazing creations come out of that, like I see an absence in the marketplace, whether it's an invention or a story, and I'm gonna go fill it. That then start with you with, okay, let me think of a character. Let me think of a storyline. What was the first like building block that you then put down for the actual story that ended up being written?
So the story was there already. And I think part of it too was this moment. I would say the second sort of moment for me was, you know, coming out of the election, which is obviously what inspired me to launch Phenomenal, the brand, the women's brand, but also thinking about, you know, my becoming a mom and how I wanted to raise my kids. And given how I was raised, there's, you know, no question for me that I want to emulate what my grandmother did, what my mother did. And it was very formative for me. And I think all the time about, you know, how can I do that for my own girls? Mm. And there were these, you know, not only did I have the experience of growing up in a household where I was constantly seeing these incredible, strong, independent, you know, smart women who were doing incredible things in the world. I saw it, you know, before my own eyes, but I also heard all these stories too, right? About my mom and aunt growing up or my grandmother growing up, and drew a lot of inspiration from that. And so one of them was this story about my mom and aunt deciding to turn an unused courtyard in their apartment building into a children's play area. And so that's the story, right? It's based on a true story. It's a family story. And so in many ways it was about, you know, memorializing that and sharing that with my own girls, but then realizing, wow, I can share this with, you know, children all over the world through a book. Mm-hmm. And part of it, I would say the third sort of moment again was with the sort of intersection with Phenomenal Woman, where I spent the last 3.5 years talking to adult women about the very, you know, themes that are in this kid's book, which are, how do I show up? How do I use my voice? How do I do more? How do I, you know, make an impact, a real impact? And I tell people this all the time. It can feel overwhelming, especially in today's world. It can feel daunting, but you start somewhere, you start small, and that's okay. And you never know where that will lead you. And that's very much also the lessons in the book. And I realized, you know, as I was having a lot of these conversations with women who, for many of them, I think for the first time were sort of coming into this identity around using their voice or being an activist or, you know, being more civically engaged and thinking about more ways they could do that, let alone, you know, for those who are moms and parents, how do I raise my kids in that way, right? How do I sort of inject this into my household? How do I do more than, you know, take my kid to a march? How do I really sort of, you know, consistently, continuously engage with this stuff in a way that's meaningful and going to have an impact on my kids? And as small and simple as it is, I think of it in that way, sort of, you know, not as a handbook, but almost, you know, that that's where you can start, right? Start in yeah. your backyard, start in your, you know, apartment complex, in your school, in your community. And it's whatever you want to call it. It's like giving a damn, being an activist, being kind to your neighbor, right? Yep. Showing up for others. These are just like really basic lessons that I think are super important for children, of course, but yep. I also think, you know, adults can take a lot from.
Yeah. And that, yeah, I'm curious when you're writing a children's book, speaking of the adult, because it's an interesting one, because you're telling a story, or you're writing a story that has to be interesting for the child, because right. that's a primary audience, but it's going through an adult who's usually reading it for a lot of kids. So I'm guessing that you also have to have the adult in mind. And did you find that when you were writing, did you have the adult in mind? And if not, like, at what point were you thinking about the way that the content is engaging with adults?
Yeah, that's a super interesting question. I will say the toughest part of writing it was, I think, almost like unconsciously writing it as an adult for an adult. And in part because I'm trained as a lawyer. So, you know, very kind of formulaic writing, sometimes can be verbose and long-winded. And so I remember, I mean, I just sort of like let it pour out. And I'm also at the same time as, you know, I'm trained as a lawyer, I'm also artistic. And so I was thinking about it and conceiving of it visually and sort of as I was turning the page and what are the scenes, right, of the story. And so sort of those two sides of my brain and trying to reconcile them, and what it turned out for the first draft was, you know, I would say I actually should go back and actually like look at my first drafts and what ended up being the book. But I think my visual representation actually stayed pretty true.
Cool.
Of my first sort of drawings and drafts of the visuals ended up, you know, staying kind of the same. But what really changed was the writing. And part of it was needing to cut it down to really simplify it, right? To take what was originally like a paragraph of me just doing way too much and really, you know, distilling it into the most important, like, five words of, you know, a sentence that allows a child to not only, you know, understand and retain, but I think the beautiful part of it too is to use your imagination to sort of fill in the rest, right? And to use the images to do that, to look at the characters. So it was an interesting process and definitely challenging for me to kind of, you know, cut down all of the writing. But what is very interesting, and now that you're kind of making me go back through and walk through this process, I'm pretty sure that the visual images and the, you know, page one, page two, and each of the different scenes stayed very much the same.
Very cool. So I think I've been told I mentioned to you that I interviewed Jonathan London, another children's book author, for the podcast. And I think I remember him telling me that normally with children's books, the author has no say in who the illustrator is, and they pretty much just turn over text to the publisher, and then the publisher has like a list of illustrators that they trust, that are experienced. So what was the interplay for you working with an illustrator? Because it sounds like those were key to the actual formation of the story in your mind.
Absolutely. So that's totally right. And it was something that initially was sort of like jarring to me and unexpected as a new author and not being very familiar with the process, especially, you know, illustrating a kid's book, where I'm trying to remember what step of the way it was. I think I had, you know, sort of put the proposal together. I had my draft. And then again, as somebody who's creative and visual, I immediately like went to Instagram and started saving all of these illustrators that I was like, I want that one, or I love her and I love her style. the one thing that was super, super important to me was that it was a woman of color. Mm-hmm. And so my initial sort of looking around and finding my dream illustrator was guided by that. And
you know, just also, like going on Instagram and going like hashtag illustrator or
yeah. I mean, there's different ways of finding, you know, okay. But yes, absolutely. And I stayed up for like hours and I loved it. I mean, it was so cool to sort of see all of these beautiful, right, artists. I'm going to look at my phone. I swear I still have this note in my phone where I was like, it'll probably take some time to find it, but I think it's still in here.
Reaching out to the author or the illustrator?
No, just like saving their Instagram.
Oh yeah.
Oh my God. Here it is. It's a note that says Black women illustrators, Indian, Latina. Like it's a whole like list of illustrators.
Oh wow. That's amazing.
So yeah. And I think there's even more. I'm like, there's so many different notes in here. So just going crazy finding.
Don't delete that. You gotta save that. The building blocks, the first bricks that were laid.
Exactly. So the date on this is March 17th, 2018. So okay. It was really, really early days. And anyway, that's all to say that when I then, got a publisher and was becoming more familiar with the process, I found out that I had no choice at all and that I wasn't going to get to sort of, you know, pick from my wish list. And then instead the publisher basically gives you, you know, a handful of choices. And for me, as I said, what was very important was to have a woman of color. Mm-hmm. We chose Anna because she not only is, you know, from Oakland where I'm from, where she's based in Oakland. She is just this incredible visual artist who did visual development for Coco, which is a favorite film of my kids. And I just loved her style. It's very vibrant, colorful, a lot of florals. I love flowers. And if you've seen the film Coco, oh my God, I mean, it's just stunning. All of the beautiful, you know, contrast, of all these vibrant colors that really, I mean, it's obviously representative of Mexican, artwork, as well as it reminds me somewhat of Jamaican art styles, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Of the high contrast, vibrant colors. Anyway, it's just gorgeous. And it's one of those things where for me, again, as a visual creative person, I knew immediately that she's mm-hmm. the illustrator that I wanted. And so, as much as the process was not what I expected, I feel so lucky that we got to work with her and that she's the illustrator for the book.
That's so cool. And then throughout when you were talking about one of the challenging parts was editing your own language, and I'm guessing that the illustrations went through editing as well. What was the editing process like? And were you handing over to your husband and say, hey, can you read through this paragraph? Or were you going back and forth to the publisher like a bunch of times to get some of those notes and start to really hone in the story?
For sure. Yeah, I was a very active editor, and bless her for being very patient with all of my edits. And I'm also very active seeker of feedback from my family and friends, who I'm sure love me harassing them all the time about their opinions. So yes, I did that of, you know, asking friends and family, what do you think about this? I would say the biggest sort of back and forth where I wanted to really get it right was around diversity, skin color, and hair texture. Mm-hmm. And part of it was, again, thinking about my girls reading the book and wanting them to see their hair, wanting them to see, you know, their community represented. A lot of their other elements too of wanting to get it sort of right in terms of the representative of the reality of what my grandmother's house looked like. When my mom and I were growing up, including, you know, having Indian pillows and other sort of cultural, you know, symbols and things that they had and that were a big part of our household and really important in terms of teaching us about our various cultures. And so, you know, the mango prints, right? And getting all of that right. So I guess it was really about making it as representative as possible of what the reality was of what I saw as a kid and what I imagined to be the case for my mom and aunt, and from, you know, photos I saw. There's actually, I haven't shown it yet, but there's this incredible image. It's in the book, I'm going to get the terminology, but like the flaps, Is that what it's called?
Okay, like
I should probably, as an author, I should probably know all these technical terms. Anyway, it's this incredible image that was always on my grandmother's bookshelf. When you walked into her house, it was, you know, right there in the entryway. And it's this photo of my mom and aunt. I think they were like 7 and 9, maybe a little bit older. And they're sitting back to back, you know, their arms crossed, looking very seriously at the camera. But they just look so powerful. And the way I describe it in the author's note is that they look like they had just like conquered the world. My mom, who was more like into sports, is like holding a soccer ball. And I think one of them has like a bandana on their hair. It's just such a great image. And it ended up inspiring the cover. Mm. And so, you know, they're just these really kind of the personal touches, right? And the other elements that have personal significance, but also thinking about, you know, who do I imagine reading this book and how I want it to speak to them, starting with my own girls, right? Seeing their pom-pom hairstyle or the braids or, you know, their tennis shoes. So I took a lot of care with that. And the illustrator was very kind and patient with all of my, you know, feedback. And she was wonderful.
That's great. Yeah, I'm always fascinated in that interplay and that shared control, because so many artists, like their art that they're creating is from such a personal place and they have such a vision in their mind. And then, but to often create the best stories that you possibly can, you do need to share control with others, and a way of like giving others creative control so they feel inspired by the project. They can let their style come out, but also preserve the vision that you have in your head and what's personal to you is like a delicate balance to strike. So that's cool.
Totally. That it worked out. It's interesting. I mean, I'd love to, I should seek out, you know, other authors talking about this, in that obviously there are a lot of authors who are also illustrators. There are other authors who are like me, who sort of creative and visual minded, but I imagine there's also a lot of authors who are not. And actually, you know what? I did just listen to a podcast and I was really struck by a kind of on this topic, where the author said, I believe she said, you know, the illustrator turned the main character into a girl of color. And that was really lovely. And I was like, that's so interesting that that was like a surprise to you, and that that was not sort of intentional. And, you know, I think everyone's different. And so for me, to your point, it was much more like collaborative storytelling, right? And the, of course, with a children's picture book, the images are so central to telling the story. But I could imagine for other authors who may not be as visual or, you know, as sort of focused on that, may have given up a little bit. I don't want to use the word given up control, right? But just sort of let the illustrator do their thing. Whereas for me, it was a much more collaborative process. Yeah. And there weren't any surprises in the end. Like, oh, wow, the main character is a little girl of color. No, that was very intentional from the beginning.
What was it like? Can you kind of share the story of sharing it with your own kids for the first time?
So I've not read it to them yet. I'm like, I don't know what I'm waiting for, but I just, I showed it to them. I showed them the FNG, which again, I don't even know what that stands for. I forget. But it's like, it's basically an unbound pile of papers of the pages, right?
Gotcha.
And then we have a sample of the actual book. I haven't received the shipments yet of like the actual, you know, printed books for everyone and before they go to the stores. I don't know. I think part of it is like, I almost want to like preserve it, and I don't want to like crinkle the pages, or I don't know what it is. I'm like, I'm not ready yet. I haven't fully read it to them. I felt like it would be fun to do it like launch week and like make it a moment. I don't know. I've been saving it. I need to do it. I'm so excited though. I showed it to them. I obviously let them hold it, and I'm talking about it like it's this like precious jewel or something. But, you know, and showed them the cover and said, look, that looks like just like your hair, doesn't it? Isn't that so cool? And that's grandma and auntie. And this is, you know, they're two little girls, just like you and Mila, just like you and your sister.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited to read it to them.
How do you think, thinking about this idea of like storytelling and how it shapes our identity, and just the decision that you made for the main characters to be two young girls, as opposed to what we were talking about, with animals, like two animals, or which most children's books are, or even like, you know, choosing a story of your mother and your aunt nowadays, who are like crushing it in what they do now. How does that change the way that identity is shaped for children in your mind?
So I'm not a child psychologist or educator, but my guess and what I see through my kids is that they relate to characters that are more like them that they can see themselves in. So if it's a, you know, girl character or a, you know, or a child, right, they are intrigued by that. They want to emulate what that character is doing. There's no question that, you know, they do that with adults also. I mean, there was, she still says it. My older one says, I want to be a president. You know, I want to be a lawyer, right? Anything that we talk to them about or, you know, tell them stories about. But I think there's something pretty significant in looking at another child and being able to see yourself in that child, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, an animal or an adult. I think the other key is, and part of it is that, you know, we have conversations in our household about phenomenal women, and she knows that she's not a woman. And then she knows, you know, the difference between a baby and a toddler and a big girl, right? Like, they know these things. And so when we talk about, you know, I want to be a president, I want to be a lawyer, she knows that that's not her reality today, right? It's something that she can aspire to in the future, but it's not sort of something that she's immediately seeing herself in. Mm. And likewise, I think I spoke about the books that are about sort of women in history. And I think it's sort of a similar thing, which is it's one, it's important for them to know that history, and I want to teach that to them. But not only is it also an adult woman, a lot of them are dead. Like, they're not even like living people that you can talk about sort of what they're doing right now, right? In the way that I'm able to tell her, you know, what auntie's doing or what grandma's doing.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just, it's very literal, right? I think kids, as much as they use their imagination and we encourage that, they also perceive the world very literally, and it's basic.
Yeah. And I was just thinking after I asked the question, like, because your Aunt Kamala is such a public figure, like, yes, the main characters are young girls, which allow us like an access point to being identifiable with, but it's no secret who these girls are now.
Right.
And so like, to be able to say like, oh, that is me. And then to also, they're smart enough to know
what they can become or what that looks like in the future.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's really powerful. So this episode is going to come out when your book launches.
Yay. Awesome.
What are you hoping that people will take away when they get a hold of this book?
So much. I think first and foremost, from sort of a broader social justice perspective, I want people to take away from this book that girls are powerful and girls are leaders and we should listen to them. We adults should listen to girls and follow their lead and listen to their big ideas and help them to achieve them. I know it sounds so like corny, but as I've engaged so much with, you know, issues around women's equality and through my brand and then having kids, just understanding that so much of this stuff starts so early, so much of the bad stuff starts so early in terms of what we're encouraging, you know, how we're talking to boys about how they treat girls and see women. Like, this is really important stuff. And by the time that we're talking about, you know, pay equity or pay inequity, it's like too late, right? Like it's way far along. And so first and foremost, it's important for me to really think about this from the lens of girls' equality and to make sure that we are really having a robust conversation that is on par with women's equality, because it's as important or perhaps more important, right? In terms of really getting this stuff right early on. And more than that, having the power and influence to do it right instead of wrong, which is teaching boys to see girls as fully formed human beings, capable of having interesting big ideas, capable of giving consent and saying yes and no, and for that to be respected and to see them as leaders, right? I think I talk a lot about this book in terms of what I want people to take away of it from it through the lens of other girls or other girls of color, but it's also important for boys. It's important for white children, right, to see diverse characters and to likewise see them as leaders and to support their big ideas. So that's what I want people to take away from it. I also think, as I said at the beginning, it's really the lessons in it are things that adults can take away from it, right? How do I wake up, see something, and decide that I'm going to go do something about it? See, you know, the way I did with the book itself, I saw this gap, as you phrase it, like, you know, this gap in the marketplace. And I said, I'm going to go do something about that, right? Each of us can do that. And as I said, I never intended to be an author. I never intended to start like this phenomenal woman company, now a fully fledged like business. I never intended to do that. But what I did do was decide I'm going to do something. I'm going to take that first step. I'm going to print that t-shirt. I'm going to, you know, write that draft of the kids' book. And I didn't know where it was going to go. I didn't know where it would take me. And I think each of us can bring that to our everyday lives. I think we can bring it to our parenting. Mm-hmm. And as much as I'm hoping to share this with others, obviously, it's also a reminder to myself, right? I wrote this because I, as a parent, was thinking about how do I achieve what my grandmother did so well? How do I achieve what my mother did in their parenting, and remind myself that it's a continuous, you know, commitment and telling these stories and engaging with it in every way and every medium and every, you know, platform. And it's just me doing my part too. So I always say that, you know, this is like really basic stuff, but you have to start somewhere, no matter how small. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe it'll lead to raising a really cool kid that does awesome stuff in the world for other people and for their communities. Maybe it leads to, you know, writing a kid's book. I don't know, but you got to wake up and decide that you're going to do something.
Amazing. So the title of the book, everyone, is Kamala and Maya's Big Idea. Mina, where can people get the book and where can people follow you?
Yeah, so we have a whole website dedicated to the book, phenomenalgirl.com. And you can buy the book at you know, traditional booksellers, but I'm really proud too that we have this pre-order campaign with independent bookstores across the country. We launched it before, obviously, you know, the pandemic happened, and now we're seeing that it's more important than ever, where, you know, local booksellers, independent bookstores are struggling to stay afloat, struggling to stay in business. And pre-orders, online orders are what are, you know, keeping them afloat. And so that's how you can not only support my book, but also support local bookstores, is by buying the book from them. You can reach me on, I don't know, Twitter, maybe not. Twitter's like not my most like best model of being a parent.
Don't reach her on Twitter.
A lot. my Twitter is a little bit more like political, but Instagram, I've been posting a lot about the book there.
Cool.
And my Instagram is just Mina, M-E-E-N-A. So yeah, you can find me online.
Awesome.
And before you go, the last question that I always ask every person who comes on the show, and now because you're an author, you absolutely are qualified to answer this, which is, what advice do you have for people who want to become better storytellers?
I think to become a better storyteller, the best thing you can do is think about the stories or the perspectives that only you uniquely can tell in a really authentic, interesting way. If someone else can tell that story in a more unique, authentic, or interesting way, then, you know, maybe it's not your story to tell, number one. But number two, I think that that's how you really capture an audience, and how you tell it in a compelling, you know, engaging way is where it's really coming from, a deep, you know, personal place.
Yeah.
And the moment that you sort of, I think, get off that path, I think it just becomes difficult, because it's not true to, you know, sort of, you know, who you are, your experience, your unique perspective. I think, and as I'm sure you've kept up with, I mean, we're having a lot of interesting conversations right now in terms of, you know, authors telling other people's stories. And I think it's a really important thing to think about, that, you know, people who are impacted and affected by, you know, certain issues or experiences, they are the people who should be telling their own stories. And those of us who may have more access to be able to distribute those stories, to get those stories out, should have a responsibility to help others tell their stories, right, versus telling them for them.
Right.
And so, you know, I think it's important to that North Star should be, is this something that's uniquely coming from me and yeah. something that, you know, not many other people can talk about in the same way is, I think, my number one, approach to storytelling.
I love it. Mina Harris, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you for having me. So fun to see you. Thanks again.
That's it for episode 41 of the Austin Meyer podcast. Woo! We are closing in on that half century mark. Thank you so much to Mina Harris for joining the podcast and to you for listening. If you want to check out Mina's book, the title is Kamala and Maya's Big Idea and it is currently up for pre-order. The official launch is June 2nd and you can learn more about the book at www.phenomenalgirl.com. Please go check that out. If you're enjoying the show, please consider leaving a rating and review of the podcast on Apple Podcasts and reach out to me on social at Austin Meyer Films to let me know what you thought of this episode. I love hearing feedback from listeners about what resonated with you and who you'd like to hear me interview in the future. So reach out and say hello. I'm sending everyone a big hug during these tough times. We're getting through it together. And with that, I will see you on the next episode of the Austin Meyer podcast. And until then, go out and tell some stories.